The track record of humanitarian leaders have been to be too cautious in 9 out of 10 cases. The government, the army, the armed groups, the extremists, the terrorists are very effective in scaring us, and we are very good at being scared. Too many people being too scared means that the few who speak up are more exposed. I was not able to get others to do the same at the time. We have to speak up. It's been the right call to not be quiet when we see atrocities.
Protection leadership means ensuring that the safety, the dignity, and the rights of the people affected by humanitarian crises guide every decision we make. Humanitarian leaders in field operations need to work together to advocate and to keep attention firmly on those most at risk. Protection is everybody's business. Hello and welcome to the Protection Leadership Podcast. I am Panos Mumsis, and as a host to the Protection Leadership Podcast, I have one simple goal: to demystify what protection leadership is about. And to do that, I have today with me a distinguished guest, Jan Egeland. Jan, welcome. We're really delighted to have you with us.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Jan has had a long, distinguished career as an Undersecretary General, Emergency Relief Coordinator at the United Nations, Secretary of State, and many decades, I would say, more of being a humanitarian practitioner, a strong voice, never fearing of speaking truth to power and bringing really the issues that affect the people that we care for at the field level. So, Jan, I would like to ask you in this conversation about the role of courage in leadership. And you have been somebody who has always known, no matter where the situation is, to speak truth to power, to really be able to bring the focus on the people and the most critical issues that they have faced from wherever they are. So can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Yeah, of course. I've been now in humanitarian work, human rights work, peace work, since I was a teenager, in the sense that I started up in Colombia at the age of 19. Colombia, which was even at that time in a horrific internal armed conflict. For me, it's been a moral issue that we have to talk publicly and forcefully about what we see and what we witness. It's not enough to say, oh, I feel pity for these people. Maybe I should send them a blanket. Maybe I should give something to the Red Cross so that one day they can help. We're witnesses. We have to speak up, both in private channels, if they are effective, but it's not, in my experience, enough to bring witness privately to decision makers. There has also to be a public accounting for what is happening. Of course, I've also been lucky and privileged in the sense that I have never really been that afraid for my job, my future, my family, my income, when I speak up and out. And therefore, I have often also ended up in controversies because I called a spade a spade. And even my organization have been, Norwegian Refugee Council, suspended in countries because of that. But all in all, it's been the right call to not be quiet when we see atrocities.
Yeah. So some people worry that, of course, speaking truth to power may get them called persona non grata, asked to leave the country, or may even limit access. And that, some critics say, have made us be a little bit risk averse. And in many situations, perhaps we have been too silent in terms of, because, you know, as humanitarians, we witness things, we hear things. So where do you draw this line between courage and what some would call reckless leadership? So where is the middle line?
Of course, it is also a judgment call. We are not going to make a grand statement knowing that it will lead to end of access and end to programs. We're not there to please fellow advocates were there to exert positive change. Of course, there has to be a judgment call, but I would really venture here that the track record of humanitarian leaders have been to be too cautious in 9 out of 10 cases.
Wow.
In the sense that they feel that the other side, the government, the army, the armed groups, the extremists, the terrorists, are very effective in scaring us, and we are very good at being scared all the time. That doesn't help the vulnerable that we're there to help. And of course, that too many people being too scared means that the few who speak up are more exposed. So my organization, the Norwegian Refugee Council, was catastrophically suspended in Ethiopia. It is a well-known case. After the Tigray, a few years back, when there was no access to Tigray, there were horrific things happening in Tigray. The research now shows that it's possibly the greatest loss of civilian lives this decade, worse than Ukraine and Gaza and elsewhere. We had no access. I felt there was a moral issue to tell the world, really.
Yeah.
When most of the UN agencies and the INGOs said nothing, of course, NRC and MSF were exposed. And we were then suspended. We had to lay off 500 staff. 400,000 people did not get aid for 6 months. Then we were able to come back, and now we have a large program again in Ethiopia. It was not a mistake to speak out, but it was a mistake that I was not able to get others to do the same at the time, and therefore we were suspended. And of course, overnight, everybody lay low. So of course, the repressive leadership often learn that the more they are tough with some, the rest fall in place and lay low, and which means that the repressive forces win. They shouldn't win. We should win in the end.
Yeah. No, this is an unfortunate, of course, extreme situation where the suspension takes place and everybody wants to avoid getting to this point. And therefore, is this kind of space to push the red line to a point to many leaders say, would my organization back me if I take a principal position? Do you think there is enough backing in the system? And what happens to an extreme situation like you described where somebody had to suspend or even leave?
No, I've many times said that a humanitarian coordinator, and they are supposed to be field marshals in aid and in protection. That's why you have humanitarian coordinator. I designed the modern humanitarian coordinator system in the 2005 reform together with the cluster systems and the SURF and so on. They were empowered to be the leaders with a humanitarian country team. If an HC is PNG'd for speaking up on behalf of women, children, families that are hunted and killed, the person should be promoted in the UN system, should not be sent to Siberia to have a cooling down. I think in the past, there was unfortunately cases of people saying, ooh, I was punished by my organization because I stood up for rights. I was not promoted. I was demoted afterwards. The current leadership tells me that that has completely changed. I believe them. So that would mean that some of the humanitarian coordinator should really be much more proactive in standing up against armed escort, standing up for protection initiatives, standing up for speaking out on how the displaced are treated, standing up for calling out armed groups of what they're doing. Because an NGO alone is too exposed.
Yeah, so collective leadership is important, kind of bringing more than one voice together in terms of...
But it's not a collective of humanitarian coordinators. It's one humanitarian coordinator.
Yeah, in-country collective.
But it's true that if the humanitarian coordinator is alone and the head of and the director of World Food Programme, UNICEF and UNHCR and the other UN agencies do not stand by him or her, the person is again too exposed, too alone. There has to be, I felt in Ethiopia, I went public on that, where were the UN agencies? I mean, it was very clear that there was horrific things happening in Tigray. We were prevented from access. We should have spoken up collectively under the leadership of the humanitarian coordinator.
So bringing under this one leadership, and the role of leadership is really vital. Jan, we live in a world with more than 200 million people having forced to flee within or across borders. When we look at the news every day, whether it's Gaza or Ukraine or Sudan or the Democratic Republic of Congo, the pictures are really grim. Civilians are daily being attacked, hospitals, schools, kindergartens, markets, residential areas. Humanitarian workers are being attacked. We had in 2025 the highest number of casualties that is taking place. So when we talk about the so-called centrality of protection, the leadership of protection at the country level to be able to move forward and support them, why should people kind of care? And what's the role of advocacy to change and influence basically politicians or decision makers or leaders who hold the arms and really to make these terrible atrocities on civilians?
Well, I mean, humanitarian work goes back to the Battle of Solferino in 1859. We have the Geneva Conventions of the 1860s. I mean, so humanitarian work is 150 years old, really. It was always about two things: aiding people with physical aid in their hour of greatest need, and protecting them from the violence as protected civilians or wounded or sick or prisoners. It was always both. In long periods, we're sort of forgetting the second thing. It's how many blankets, how many tents, how many tons of rice was delivered. That was the matrix. No, it's not only that. It's also how many times did we act to end impunity for the people who caused the suffering by attacking civilians, villages, bombing the hospitals, bombing the residential areas. It's not just bleak, Panos, and it's important for us in after a very tough year, 2025, facing another tough year, 2026, to remember that many more civilians died in the 1990s than in the last 10 years. Many more. It was the age of the genocides, really. The reason that there is a world record now in killed humanitarian colleagues, possibly in killed health workers, teachers, and so on, is because of the indiscriminate bombing in Gaza. Take away Gaza, it's not unique this last year, which means also that the presence of humanitarian programs like never before this last 10 years has also dampened the loss of life, prevented some atrocities. There is more immediate focus on the bombing of hospitals in 2025 than there was in 1985 when it also happened. That is a positive sign. So we now have to build on that and bring all of the humanitarian organizations up to understanding the centrality of protection, which is that, no, it's not just giving the stuff. It is also discussing what can we do that we're not doing today to be present with the women of Eastern Congo so they are not gang raped every single time a militia is taking over the village. What has happened to the commanders of those militias? Government, army colonels for that matter. Why is there still impunity? Who gives the arms to these groups? How can we expose that? How can we work with human rights groups to seek accountability? What can the High Commissioner for Human Rights be doing that we as humanitarians with field workers cannot easily do?
No, indeed. I think finding what the right action and how to move it is the way forward. Now, Jan, you're somebody who has contributed also in the architecture of the system and a lot of the policies. And more than 10 years ago, in 2012-13, we issued this interagency standing committee group that brings together the UN, the NGOs, the Red Cross, a policy that we call the centrality of protection, the leadership of protection. Here we are more than 10, 12 years later on, and there's still questions about how to apply it and how to take it forward. Why would you say it's so difficult? What's the main reason it's kind of not moving to the level that everybody would like to see it?
Well, in the first place, I think in this year of retrospection and reflection, which is 2025 with all of the cuts and so on, the policies of the last 25 years, they're too wordy. There's too many words there, and too many slogans and too many seminars and too many panels, side panels and consultants and discussion groups and webinars and seminars on it. It's very basic principles where we have at stake. And people should be protected from violence because they're protected people. You don't need that. You don't need 20 pages to describe it. It's pretty simple. Secondly, there was too little always on the tools. How can we be present with and for and among the people as unarmed, vulnerable humanitarian workers? That's, to me, perhaps the main discussion often. How can we bring information real time about threats? Here's a village. It's going to be overtaken by this armed group. They're going to be massacred unless we do something.
Yeah.
Give you one example. Why isn't there more attention to Kadugli? It's a besieged town, city in southern Kordofan in Sudan. It's besieged now with SPLM and RSF, and those soldiers will likely commit atrocities if and when they take Kadugli. It's not rocket science to see that this is a countdown to a disaster, potentially on the scale of Al-Fashir in northern Darfur, which was a 500 days and nights countdown to massacres. Who can influence the armed groups? Who can influence also the government so that there is a ceasefire and there is a negotiated solution to that conflict so that women and children and the civilians can be spared? That's the question. And how can we scale up in South Kordofan so that we can bring witness real time on how this relentless countdown is taking place?
Indeed, it's how. The question is the how and how to go about to bring it. Jan, I had the pleasure of seeing you in real action working together on the Syria crisis, where you were there at the front helping us. And I saw you in your diplomatic skills, whether it was talking to top-level government ministers, and you used all means. So in your reflection as a humanitarian coordinator and members of humanitarian country teams also, what are the options? There's a lot of frontline, public speaking out, behind doors diplomacy. And I saw you a lot on the behind doors diplomacy where you would really be very tough, but you will say things behind doors. Can you elaborate a little bit more? What are the options in today's complex and sensitive world where we live?
I think that was an interesting case, Syria, and the specific work of the humanitarian task force, which was actually Geneva-based, but working to get relief into the besieged towns of Syria during the Assad regime time. We're talking 2016, 17, 18, 19, 20. For these 2, 3, 4 years, we were able to bring at the table those countries that had influence in the areas. So at the table was Russia, very influential on the Assad regime. So was Iran. On the other side was the Western powers led by the United States and the Gulf countries that were funding the armed opposition groups. So we were then able to negotiate convoys into many of these areas that is impossible to do today to Kadugli. It was also to Al-Fashir, because those parties, or rather those who have influenced the parties, are not sitting at the table like that. I was hammering the point that the blood is on your hands, really. Look at these children, the children of Daraya, which one very symbolic besieged town of Syria, and these children were starving to death, really. And we were able to get in one convoy after the other. We went to a place called Rukban. I think we had agreement with 10 different armies and armed groups to be able to go into the place. But it was also public diplomacy. So after each humanitarian task force, of course, these influential people knew I was going 200 paces and there were 20 TV cameras waiting. And there I was just saying, this is what we achieved. This is what we've not been able to achieve. This is the situation for Douma, Daraya, Eastern Aleppo, etc., etc. And I was very honest with all of our failures, but also with the successes.
No, indeed, that was a very effective way to be able to bring it down. And of course, we now see all the changes that have taken place in Syria. You spoke a lot about the role of the humanitarian coordinators, but of course, in humanitarian country teams, you have heads of UN agencies, you have international NGOs, you have national NGOs, you have ICRC as an observer, actually, who comes there. So what would you say is the role of the NGOs, for example? And NRC has been very active, but how about also the role of the national actors in this?
Now, we all play complementary roles, really. So much of the leadership, the heavy lifting, the diplomacy with government, especially at times also with the armed groups, falls to the UN. Indirectly also to the ICRC, which have their own channels. International non-governmental organizations need to have strong advocacy. Also when the UN, for rightly or wrongly, feels they cannot speak up and out. We have to. And at times, we are too few. So I often hear, we're right behind you, Jan. Maybe you should come up with me.
To the front.
I say that we're right behind you. Go on. Push. You have to. Which again means that my organization will be suspended in 3 countries, 2 more than Ethiopia. And I had 5 heads of state calling for my removal when I was the emergency relief coordinator, but Kofi Annan, Secretary General, stood by me and had my back. Very important also for the emergency relief coordinator. As the humanitarian coordinator needs to know, they had the emergency relief coordinator behind them. We all have to have the back of people who are exposed. The local groups have also a very important role. They have expertise, they have knowledge, they have contacts that none of us have. We could be better in really listening to them, interviewing them, getting advice from them. Why are all these young men joining these groups? Where is the successful ways of addressing the armed actors? Is it possible to reach them by the elders, by religious leaders? How can we get in contact on these groups that have now men who abuse the civilians? But it's a myth that the local groups can work everywhere and easily. They are as exposed, sometimes more exposed than internationals, from the regime and the governments and even armed groups side. So we need to help them, empower them, and also know that they do not necessarily live by the humanitarian principles if they are on one side of the conflict, one side of the front lines, and not the other side. They are more easily under pressure from the armed groups than we can be as more privileged international actors.
Yeah. No, I'd like to stay on this point a little bit, which is really our responsibility. On the one hand, of course, with the localization, we are empowering, we are delegating, we are giving more space, more respect, more really what it should be in the humanitarian sector to the local actors. Now, when it comes to leadership on protection, how do we make sure that we're not transferring risk in a way, because they're much more vulnerable than us internationals, where at the end of the day, you know, we may move somewhere else. Well, for national actors, they have their loved ones, their families, their homes. So how do we keep that balance on protection leadership when we're talking about local actors?
Assistance and protection very much overlap. There is, especially in the past, there has been a lot of risk transfer to the frontline groups. We, in my time in OCHA and afterwards, I did a report with humanitarian outcomes, which was on protection and proximity to people, and an important report that calls Stay and Deliver still stands well. There, we also documented how many more national and local aid workers were killed, arrested, maimed, than internationals. The national went out around in all sorts of protective gears, pretty far from their fighting often, and the local groups had nothing when they were delivering at the front lines. So that's become better, more training, more common risk-taking, risk management, I think, in nearly all contexts. Certainly my organization is now much better in doing that. On protection, I would say that the internationals have to lead more than the local groups. Really, protection means calling a spade, saying things that people with guns do not like to hear. Nobody likes to hear that they committed massacres in Al-Fashir, or the arms came from the Gulf, or that the Russians have now bombed yet another hospital and the arms came from here or there. We need to say that. The local groups cannot so easily say that, especially if it's the government that is involved in this. But the information can come from them. So often the information can come from local groups to an international group that we would hand over to the High Commissioner for Human Rights, that again should have accountability measures, so that one day the war criminal will meet justice.
Yeah. No, thank you. You're bringing also another point, which is, what can we say locally in the country, in the capital or where we are? And one could be said in Geneva or New York or Washington or Doha or other places to be able to bring it, which is an important point.
And in general, we should shield our field workers and even our country directors. Again, humanitarian coordinator has to speak up and out. I would say the director of the large UN agencies have to speak up and out. They're not going to throw out a large UN agency that is providing millions of dollars worth of assistance. And leaders can be substituted. It's not the end of the world if your organization has someone PNG'd. Not the end of the world either for me if I have someone not getting a visa because of this and that. We can continue to work. Often it would fall upon me as the Secretary General now of the Norwegian Refugee Council. We have a TV studio in our premises. I'm on BBC and CNN and Al Jazeera every month, year after year after year after year. with these messages, and I will continue to do that. And we shield our national staff, on our country directors.
Yeah, I know. And thank you for doing that, because that's very important to have that moral voice as things are happening. So, Jan, if I was to ask you to change one thing in the humanitarian system that will bring this protection leadership, this centrality protection, from a slogan to a practice, what would be this one change?
I would want smaller humanitarian country teams to start with, not 50, 60, 70 people joining, some on video, some in the room, and hearing powerful presentations on the various subgroups of the protection cluster and so on, and a lot of words on centrality of the protection, and another seminar and another panel on that. I want the humanitarian country teams to be small, with those who are operational in the front lines, with local partners, with the map on the table, so we as an operations room say, who's here, who's there, who's going to speak to that group, who will speak to that group, who will speak up and out on the countdown to the massacre that we all fear coming. How can we best split our work? And what will the humanitarian coordinator, the leader, do vis-a-vis the government? On our behalf, what can the UN agencies do to back that up? That's what I would like to see, basically. Operations rooms. I've often spoken about the Kivu test. What's the Kivu test? It means that what we do have to make life more safe, secure, and better for the women in Eastern Congo. Another seminar in a capital in Europe with a panel and a representative of the women, where we all clap and feel good, hasn't really worked for the women. 25 years and they're still being raped. Has to be action there. In Eastern Congo, my organization have tried to do a lot with local partners, with the local communities. I think we can all do more to pass the Kivu test.
Yeah, the Kivu test, really kind of simplification in the system, what I hear from you, yep, in terms of processes, coordination,
mechanism. Simplification and also focus on field action.
Field action.
Not events.
No, very important. Jan, you've had a long career. You said you started at the age of 19. You've been for several decades working in the humanitarian sector. So my question is, what do you hope would be your lasting impact in terms of protection of civilians and the way as a system will respond?
It's not going to be much lasting impact from any of us, given how the world is rapidly changing, new generations of armed groups and armed actors and governments and more nationalism, more xenophobia, all of the things that we're fighting now. What I hope to pass on in my organization and within the all of the groups that I have been dealt with is this passion for change for the people we serve, really. That's what I hope. And I keep saying internally, when they say, ooh, should we really publish this? Should we really see that? And so on. Yes, because it's a soul of our organization to do that. It's the soul of us as humanitarian. I hope I have influenced some of the younger to do that.
No, thank you. You've certainly been an inspiration for many of us working in the humanitarian sector. So Jan Egeland, thank you so much for joining me today on the Protection Leadership Podcast, and wish you the very best for NRC and all your work and
thank
and
you.
You're doing.
Thank you, Panos, for all that you're doing for protection.
Thank you. And to you, our listeners, I really want to thank you for joining us today in the Protection Leadership Podcast. Please spread the word around. Make sure that others hear about this program. And looking forward to seeing you to the next episode. Thank you and goodbye.